All right, looks like we have hit the appointed hour, 3:45. So welcome to the session, Science as Understanding Creation 2. I will introduce each speaker. I'll give them a 5-minute warning, and we'll stick to 20 minutes of discussion, 20 minutes of presentation, 5 minutes of discussion, and then transition period. So our first speaker is Hugh Ross. He's going to be speaking on testing biblical creation accounts with the latest science.
Here. Many of you know that I'm the founder of Reasons to Believe, and of course you can connect with us on a variety of social media. We maintain a 24/7 YouTube channel that you can watch to your heart's content. And if you go to 31996 on your smart device, at your portal to get lots of free videos, book chapters, and much more. And if you simply go to your computer, reasons.org/Ross, there we give you free chapters of the books that I've written, including this book, which is the subject of what I'm going to be talking about, How to Test Genesis with Advancing Science. And since I only got 20 minutes, I'm going to go through this fairly rapidly. But I will begin with Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And just so you're aware, there are atheists that have been bombarding me on Twitter, basically making the point the Bible gets it wrong from the very first verse because it says the universe and the earth were created at the same time. What they're not realizing is that this is a compound Hebrew phrase. The heavens and the earth is like the English word butterfly. Nothing to do with butter, nothing to do with fly, it's something distinct. And in biblical Hebrew, there is no word for universe. Instead, they use this compound phrase, the heavens and the earth. So it's basically a statement about God creating the totality of physical reality. This phrase is used 9 times in the Old Testament, always meaning the totality of all reality, all matter, energy, space, and time. And now we've got space-time theorems that established that Genesis 1:1 got it right. And as of today, we have 32 of these space-time theorems, and some of these theorems actually penetrate the quantum gravity era, establishing that they hold even in that quantum gravity era. One of the authors of these space-time theorems, Alexander Belinkin, wrote this a few years ago. With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. And the problem he was addressing was that proof of a space-time beginning implies there must be some causal agent beyond space and time who creates our universe of space-time, matter, and energy. And that's what isolates the God of the Bible from the gods of the other religions, or to put it another way, a miracle-working God must exist. We get all that from the very first sentence of the Bible. Now, here's an outline of what I'm going to be covering in the next 18 and a half minutes. But because it's only 18 and a half, I'm actually going to skip number 2 and just hit points 1 and point 3. And you know, a lot of people have this idea that Genesis 1 gets all the science wrong, gets all the history wrong. I was not raised in a Christian home. I didn't pick up a Bible till I was 17, but the first thing that struck me in looking at the first page of the Bible is that it followed the scientific method. And step 1 of that scientific method, don't interpret until you establish the point of view or the frame of reference. And this is what I noticed with Genesis 1:2. It establishes that the Spirit of God is telling us the story of the 6 creation days from the point of view of an observer on the surface of the waters. The Spirit of God is hovering over the face of the waters. Or, as this diagram puts it, we're to understand the description of the 6 days of creation from the perspective of an observer on the surface of an ocean that encompasses the whole earth underneath the cloud layer, not above the cloud layer. And if you go to a parallel account, Job 38, 37, 38, and 39, Proverbs 8, and Psalm 104, all take you through the content of the 6 days of creation. So I always tell skeptics, before you draw a conclusion, integrate those four biblical texts. And there's more, but those four in particular. And what you see in Job 38, and by the way, the text in Job is the most detailed of the creation texts with respect to its science content. But what you see in Job 38:9 is this statement where God speaks and says, I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness. The it referring to the seas that encompass of the earth. And notice here it explicitly tells us why it's dark on the face of the waters. It's dark because the clouds would not let any light pass through. Step two of that biblical testing method. Don't interpret until you establish the initial conditions. Notice Genesis 1:2 also gives us those initial conditions. It's dark on the surface of the waters. The waters cover the whole surface of the earth, and it's empty of life and unfit for life, but now the Spirit of God begins to work. But as you integrate Genesis 1:2 with Job 38:9, we understand why it's dark on the face of the waters, not because of a lack of light. The light would have been there when God created the universe, Genesis 1:1, but it's because that light was not able to pass through the atmosphere of the earth. Now, part of my story is I've been a serious student of astronomy since I was 7. So when I picked up the Bible for the first time at age 17, I already knew planets the size of the Earth, the distance that they are from their host star, must begin with atmospheres that are very thick, much thicker than what we see on the planet Venus. And an atmosphere that thick will not let visible light through to the surface of the Earth. And Creation Day 1, the text says, let there be light. Notice it says that let there be light. It doesn't say that God created the light or made the light. That was done on Genesis 1:1 when God created matter, energy, space, and time. This is when God allowed light for the first time to pass through the atmosphere of the earth and get to the surface. This is when the atmosphere was transformed by God from opaque to translucent, and this is where I believe we have the origin of life. Now that we got light coming through to the surface of the earth, we have the possibility for a multiplicity of microbial life forms. And then we get into Genesis 1, or the second creation day, and this is the briefest of the descriptions of the creation days. Basically, the text simply says, let there be water above and water below. Very cryptic, and has led to a lot of debate within Christian scholarship. What's going on creation day 2? Now, from my perspective, I don't see a need for the debate, because when you go to the parallel text in the book of Job, you've got 1.5 chapters that focus on creation day 2. All of Job 37 and nearly the first half of Job 38. And what you get there in the book of Job is a description of 16 different kinds of precipitation coming down from the sky. And the 6 that are identified are 3 different kinds of liquid precipitation and 3 different kinds of frozen precipitation. But what fascinates me about Job 37 and 38, it describes these different forms of precipitation we see in the water cycle and how we need all of them if we're going to have global human civilization. For example, we depend on a lot of snow falling on the California high mountains to ensure that we can grow food 12 months of the year. If all we had was the rain, we wouldn't be able to grow food in California. Just one example. And we go into this in some detail in our television documentary, Journey Toward Creation, where we describe the events that led to our having this atmosphere that was transformed. Basically, the moon-forming event stripped away 99.5% of our atmosphere and a likely similar amount of Earth's water and allowed for this water cycle to be established. I want to focus particularly on creation day 3, as I mentioned in the outline for this talk, where it says, let dry ground appear. A reference to when our planet was transformed from a water world where we have oceans and continents coexisting. And that, of course, is crucial because we need both surface oceans and surface continents to recycle the nutrients that the advanced life will require. Microbes, not a problem. But if you want plants and animals, you're going to have both surface continents and surface oceans. Now, I was reading the Bible for the first time in the 1960s. early 1960s. And as I was reading the geology textbooks at that time, what I noticed was they were all saying that the continents had been here in roughly the same form that they are today. But as I read those books at age 18, what I realized was, okay, this was simply an assumption. There really wasn't any data or understanding to support this. And as a sophomore physics student at the University of British Columbia, I noticed they were having the first course ever on plate tectonics. Two of the three Canadian physicists that launched the discipline of plate tectonics decided to teach a course on plate tectonics. And for some reason, they let me as a sophomore undergraduate to enroll in the class. And what they taught in that class, the two professors, was that this was the new model of the development of continents throughout the history of the Earth. And I remember going up to one of the professors after one of his lectures and saying, I notice you've got it somewhere around 7 to 8% of the surface of the Earth starting off with continents. Is it possible it could be down to zero? And he said, anything between 0 and 10% would work. So he says, hey, maybe the Bible got it right here. Then I want to fast forward from the 1960s to a series of papers published in the year 2000, which basically gave this understanding of the growth of the continents with respect to time, that indeed the world started off as a water world where you get small volcanic islands, then plate tectonics kicks in, very gradual, then you get this significant aggressive growth of the continents where it goes from about 3% up to 20%, and then gradually goes up to the present 29%. I said, this is a much closer fit with what I see in Genesis 1 than what I saw back in the late 1960s. But then I want you to fast forward to a paper published 1 year ago. And this is a paper published by a group of geophysicists who said, really what stimulates the growth of the continents is the oxygenation of the planet. And so they published that this new understanding of the growth of the continents, that actually you have a total water world for about the first 800 million years, then plate tectonics begins to gradually kick in, but it doesn't even hit the 2% level until the great oxygenation event. The great oxygenation event, 2.45 billion years ago, suddenly accelerates the growth of continents up to 27%, and you get a gradual increase to the present 29%, which means we have an even closer description of what we see in creation day three than we had in the year 2000. And notice you got the 6 days of creation, and we have the growth of the continents coming in at the first half of creation day three. If you take the age of the Earth, we notice you roughly get the same date from the scientific perspective as what we see claimed in the 6 days of creation in Genesis 1. Now, if you want to read about this in more detail, every week on our website, I publish an article called Today's New Reason to Believe, basically talking about a new scientific discovery that makes for a stronger case for a Christian faith. And this one was on June 11th. By the way, is June 11th, 2018, not 2019. So this slide's a little bit old. So if you go back about a year, you'll find that article on our website. And then the second half of creation day three, it says, let the land produce vegetation. And I've debated Michael Shermer, the executive director of the Skeptic Society, 4 times on university campuses, never on the subject of Genesis. It doesn't matter. When he gets his turn to speak, he ignores what he's supposed to speak about and goes after Genesis 1, because in his opinion, this is the Achilles heel of the Christian faith. And what he's done in every one of those debates is says, this is where Genesis 1 clearly gets it wrong. We get animals in the oceans first, according to the fossil record, and we get vegetation on the land masses afterwards. And your Bible puts it the other way. Now, in the first of those debates, my response was, well, Michael, animals have bones and shells. Therefore, their fossils are going to be well preserved over hundreds of millions of years. We don't expect that to be the case with vegetation. But come 2009, a paper got published in Nature where basically they said, we've now found the isotope evidence that shows us that vegetation was just as abundant on the continents for 200 million years preceding the first appearance of animals in the oceans, 5 minutes, as we did in the 200 million years thereafter. In this paper, they said we've actually found the fossils, not just isotope evidence, but actual fossils that indeed vegetation predates. Then we move into creation day 4, where it tells us that the atmosphere went from translucent to transparent. And I want to take you to an experiment by a group of physicists who noticed that this is the oxygenation history of the first 4 billion years of Earth. This is the great oxygenation event that produced the continents. But here we get the oxygen going from less than 1% to 8%. And this leads to the first appearance of animals. What they did is they did an experiment in the lab where they took the atmosphere of the Earth and varied the oxygen content from less than 1% up to 8% and observed what happens. And what they notice is below 1%, the atmosphere is so hazy, it's impossible to see the sun, moon, and stars in the sky. But as they increase the oxygen content, this is what they notice. So here, for example, is a completely hazed out sky. And this is a bunch of photos I've taken of a mountain in Colorado. And as you increase the oxygen content, we see that the mountain becomes clear and clear in view. This is Engineer Peak in western Colorado. And eventually you get to see something off to the right. There you go. The moon shows up in the sky, whereas at the beginning it was not visible at all. And again, you can pick that up in an article, June 18th, again 2018, where I described this in a paper that was published in the scientific literature. And this is actually the full story of the oxygenation content. But we see in creation day 5 is this is when we now have enough oxygen in the atmosphere that animals can be possible in the oceans. But what's interesting, when you compare the date for the jump from 1% oxygen to 8%, the moment it hits 8%, you got the Avalon animals. And then when it jumps up to 10%, immediately you got the Cambrian explosion animals. There is no time delay. You go from nothing but microbes to animals that are as big as 2 meters across the moment it jumps from 1% up to 8%. This is what Kevin Peterson, one of the leading experts on the Avalon and Cambrian explosion, said, that when you look at the scientific literature, elucidating the materialistic basis for the Cambrian explosion has become more elusive, not less, the more we know about the event itself. How am I doing on time? I'm about out 2 minutes. I might even be able to finish. All right. Want to read more about this? We're giving away a free chapter. The chapter actually deals with the Avalon and Cambrian explosions at reasons.org/Ross. You can read that for free. But the text goes on to talk about God creating a totally different kind of animal life. Animals that are not only physical, but soulish. And basically our model at Reasons to Believe is that we not only have human exceptionalism, we have nephesh exceptionalism, referring to birds and mammals and the higher reptilian species that we humans can tame to do our bidding. These are the animals that, according to the word nephesh, means that these are creatures that are designed by God to relate to us and to serve and please us, a higher species. And then as we move forward, birds and mammals, we have God creating land mammals. But I think what's important to realize here, the text never addresses when God creates the first land mammals. Instead, it jumps ahead, like you see in the book of Job, to describe those land mammal species that are most crucial for launching human civilization, making the point that we wouldn't have civilization today if it wasn't for God creating rodents, the short-legged land mammals that we need for clothing industry, and two different kinds of long-legged land mammals, those that are easy to tame that we use for agriculture, and those that are difficult to tame that make excellent household companions. I put a lion here because when I was at Caltech, we had an undergraduate student who brought his pet lion to class every day. And the lion would run down to the foot of the professor. Why? because everybody was looking at the professor. That's where the lion wanted to be, because it really wanted to engage everybody. And that lion loved to romp with the toddlers at lunchtime. And we describe this in some detail in my book, Hidden Treasures, the Book of Job. The book predominantly deals with the exceptionalism of these nephesh creatures. But last of all, the text talks about, again, a totally different kind of life form, a life form that's not only physical, but soulish and spiritual. And the point here is, God designed the birds and mammals and higher reptiles to form relationships with us, a higher species. He designed us to form a relationship with a higher being. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Minutes for questions. So I hear first, then you.
Thank you so much for the presentation. My first is alternative interpretations of Genesis, because I can see someone who's skeptical of this saying, there's no way Moses could have known this. It's not taking into account that account the historical origins, historical context in which it was written, and the near ancient Near Eastern mythologies and stuff like that. And it seems to be written to a modern scientific audience. What would you say to that?
That's a very good question, and I would argue this is inspired by the God that created the universe. He would inspire it in a way to communicate to all generations. So I would point out, for example, notice the text is silent on Neanderthals. Notice that it's silent on protons and neutrons. It's designed to use vocabulary that all generations have at least some understanding. But as we see in 1 Peter 1, there's material in the Bible that's designed to be understood by future generations. So all generations are going to see something in the text, but there is a progressive revelation according to what we see in the New Testament. So I think this is consistent. It's consistent with the first the contemporaries of Moses understanding this, but also future generations. It's for all generations.
Yes, Doctor, how did that oxygenation event cause like a quick growth in the continents?
Yes, good question. And what they're saying is that what caused the oxygenation to go up that dramatically was you had a huge erosion event. And so, and actually, if you look at the paper that I got up online, you'll see that we had these continents ready to emerge above the surface. They were barely below the surface. And then we had this catastrophic event which caused this sudden jump up of continents everywhere. So when I say there was water over the whole surface of the Earth, there was stuff going on before where it came up maybe a few hundred feet below the surface, but then suddenly it all popped up. And same thing with the second great oxygenation event. Again, it was something called the Great Unconformity. Geologically is what really caused this huge chemical overturn. So the chemistry has a lot to do with it.
Could you define for me the term soulish that you used, and then
yes,
where you got that within Genesis
1? Okay, the Hebrew word is nephesh, typically translated soulish animal. And if you look at all the places where it refers to the nephesh, especially in the book of Job, it's referring to creatures that can relate at a level of emotions, will, and a mind. And so, they're able to form relationships with one another. Any animal that will sacrifice in an emotional way for its young is in that category. And any animal that can emotionally bond with a human being is in that category. That would include all the birds and mammals and just a handful of the reptilian species.
Yeah.
Stable water cycle that you said was
yes.
Created on day 3. Which day was water created?
Oh, no, day 2 is when you get the water cycle. The water was there before the 6 creation days, because Genesis 1:2 says that water covers the whole surface of the earth. So it's before the 6 days. But you don't get a water cycle until creation day 2.
So was
water created? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and that's referring to all matter, energy, space, and time. So water's part of that matter, but exactly when we see water appearing on earth, we don't know from the Bible's perspective. From an astronomical perspective, we know It showed a very early, just within millions of years after the formation of the Earth. And the early Earth had oceans that were thousands of miles deep. But the moon forming event gave us shallow oceans.
Sai, and then
back here. This is a question in relation to your first answer to the first question. Do you think there are any passages in the Bible that we can't understand yet because we have, it's for future generations?
I would agree with that, that we're not, for example, I look at the last eight chapters of Ezekiel as a mystery to virtually every theologian that looks at the text. Every time I say that, somebody says they got it figured out, and they give me a long treatise, but as I read it, it says, nah, you really haven't got it figured out either. And that's just one example of many in the Bible. So basically what I'm saying is, if you're a theologian, don't worry about being unemployed. There's still a lot more to learn about the text.
One last question before we...
Well, I don't know. I know a lot about planetary formation, but was there a lot of volcanism and volcanoes and stuff that contributed to making the oceans or covering with water, or just tell the two sentences how that worked?
Yeah, volcanism will return some water to the Earth, but it's not like it's going to be the source of the Earth's primordial water. So the Earth, I mean, water is the third most abundant molecule in the universe, so I remind people the universe is soaking wet. And one of the problems with trying to find life elsewhere is that water is just so abundant. If you got too much water, you're going to have a problem. And we are finding planets with thousands of miles deep water on them, but we notice if you get that much water, the pressure of the water will make the water frozen at the bottom, which means you get an ice layer that separates the water from the rocky material below, which eliminates the possibility of life. So it was important that our planet get a thin layer of water. It began with a thick layer and then had a thin layer. We did get a little bit of water delivered to us through continents, but it was a small amount of water.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, you know what? I do answer questions on Facebook and Twitter, so if you think of a question, contact me.
Well, I mean, we don't have much time now, but I thought the Earth was hot at some time and it had to cool down for a long time and then it started happening.
That model is correct. It began hot, but it cooled relatively quickly, okay. And then you wind up with a lot of water on the face of the Earth.
And that was before Genesis, when the first two was...
And by quickly, I mean within 10 million years.
Yeah. Okay. Geologically quickly.
Geologically quickly.
Yeah. All right, let's thank our speaker.